Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, March 2nd, 2025. The following article comes from Ars Technica, posted on January 20th, 2025. Robotic hand helps pianists overcome ceiling effect. Passive training with robotic exoskeleton hand even led to motor improvements in the untrained hand. When it comes to fine-tuned motor skills like playing the piano, practice, they say, makes perfect. But expert musicians often experience a ceiling effect, in which their skill level plateaus after extensive training. Passive training using a robotic exoskeleton hand could help pianists overcome that ceiling effect, according to a paper published in the journal Science Robotics. "I'm a pianist, but I injured my hand because of overpracticing," co-author Shinichi Furuya of Kabushiki Keisha Sony Computer Science Kenkyūjō told New Scientist. "I was suffering from this dilemma between overpracticing and the prevention of the injury. So then I thought, I have to think about some way to improve my skills without practicing." Recalling that his former teacher used to place their hands over his to show him how to play more advanced pieces, he wondered if he could achieve the same effect with a robotic hand. So Furuya et al. Used a custom-made exoskeleton robot hand capable of moving individual fingers on the right hand independently, flexing and extending the joints as needed. Per the authors, prior studies with robotic exoskeletons focused on simpler movements, such as assisting in the movement of limbs, stabilizing body posture, or helping grasp objects. That sets the custom robotic hand used in these latest experiments apart from those used for haptics in virtual environments. A helping robot hand. A total of 118 pianists participated in three different experiments. In the first, 30 pianists performed a designated chord trill motor task with the piano at home every day for 2 weeks, first simultaneously striking D and F keys with the right index and ring fingers, then striking the E and G keys with the right middle and little fingers. "We used this task because it has been widely recognized as technically challenging to play quickly and accurately," the authors explained. "It appears in such classical pieces as Chopin's Etude Opus 25, No. 6, Maurice Ravel's Ondine, and the first movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 3. A photo shows a hand exoskeleton robot attached to the digits of the right hand. The device can flex and extend the metacarpophalangeal joints of the individual digits. The pianist performed the task at a tempo of 80 BPM, or beats per minute, for 10 seconds, followed by a 10-second rest for 30 sessions. After 2 weeks, they were assigned to one of two laboratory groups, in which the robot exoskeleton hand passively moved those four fingers for 30 minutes, to perform the chord trill, faster than the players could do so themselves. This was followed by a post-test session in which the pianist played the chord trill twice for 5 seconds, as quickly and accurately as possible. The second experiment was designed to pinpoint the elements of movement that led to the enhanced motor skills, involving 60 pianists randomly assigned to one of 5 groups and getting different interventions. The results: even when the skill plateaued after weeks of piano practice, passive training of the fast and complex motor skill with the robot further facilitated the maximum rate of repetitive piano keystrokes involving fast and complex multi-finger movements, the authors wrote. And the training effect also showed up in the untrained hand, so there was an intermanual transfer effect. In other words, the hand exoskeleton allows skilled individuals to achieve otherwise impossible motions and is thus an effective way to overcome the ceiling effect. A third experiment aimed to assess any changes in neuroplasticity in the corticospinal system during passive training. This involved 28 pianists undergoing the same lab-based protocol as the first experiment, while undergoing electromyographic, or EMG, monitoring and stimulated regions of the motor cortex associated with finger movements before and after training sessions. Only the hand trained by the exoskeleton showed pattern changes in multi-finger movements, which the authors suggest is evidence of neuronal adaptation from the passive training. More research is needed into why the untrained hand also showed improved motor skills. The authors acknowledge that participants were limited by the risk of muscular fatigue. For instance, one experiment involved five trials in which pianists played as fast as they could at the maximum rate for 10 seconds, but players found it difficult to do so for longer periods or for more than 10 trials. Still, the authors believe their study highlights the importance of embodying otherwise impossible skills using augmentation technology, such as a robotic exoskeleton. It could also prove useful for rehabilitation of certain neurological disorders that affect manual dexterity. Jennifer Ouellette, the author of this article in Ars Technica about robotic exoskeletons for pianists, has a particular focus on where science meets culture, covering everything from physics and related interdisciplinary topics to her favorite films and TV series. She lives in Baltimore with her spouse, physicist Sean M. Carroll, and their two cats, Ariel and Caliban. And this article was posted on January 20th, 2025. Science also meets culture in this next article from the November 2024 issue of Scientific American. Under Forum, Commentary on Science in the News from the Experts, we learn how science upstaged climate denial. A play celebrates the agreement that opened nations worldwide to accepting the science of climate change. By Ben Santer. It's a very strange experience to watch a play in which you are a character and to shake hands with the person who plays you. I did both this past July 2024 while attending a performance of Kyoto at the Swan Theater in Stratford-upon-Avon in England. The moment meant more, of course, than just a glimpse of oneself on history's stage. The play shows how science won out over climate denial in a critical face-off between scientists and industry over the future of the planet. Kyoto is about the Kyoto Protocol, an agreement made more than 25 years ago that, as summarized by the United Nations, committed industrialized countries and economies in transition to limit and reduce greenhouse gases, GHG, emissions, in accordance with agreed individual targets. Written by Joe Murphy and Joe Robertson, the play provides a dramatic retelling of an historic meeting in December 1997 in Kyoto, Japan, where the protocol was finalized. At this meeting, a key intergovernmental panel on climate change, IPCC, scientific assessment, helped to inform the international emissions reduction negotiations. The Working Group 1 part of the IPCC Second Assessment Report, which was completed in 1995 and published in early 1996. I was convening lead author of Chapter 8, Detection of Climate Change and Attribution of Causes. The role of the IPCC back in 1995 and today was to advise the governments of the world on the science and negative impacts of climate change, as well as on strategies for mitigating and adapting to those impacts. In 1990, the first IPCC scientific assessment had concluded that the jury was still out in whether a human-caused climate change signal could be identified in real-world climate data. The 1995 assessments chapter reached a very different conclusion, encapsulating in 12 simple words. The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. This was a momentous statement from cautious scientists and a rather conservative organization. Multiple factors contributed to this dramatic transition. Advances in the science of climate fingerprinting, for example, made a big difference in climate research during the 5 years between the two reports. Fingerprinting seeks to identify the unique signatures of different human and natural influences on Earth's climate. This uniqueness becomes apparent if we probe beyond a single number, such as the average temperature of Earth's surface, including land and oceans, and look instead at complex patterns of climate change. Patterns have discriminatory power and allow scientists to separate the signature of human-caused fossil fuel burning from the signatures of purely natural phenomena, such as El Niño and La Niña climate patterns, changes in the sun's energy output, and effects of volcanic eruptions. Kyoto describes some of the fingerprint evidence that was presented during a key meeting in Madrid in November 1995, ahead of the Kyoto face-off dramatized in the performance. The discernible human influence on global climate conclusion was finalized in Madrid, where the participants included 177 delegates from 96 countries, representatives from 14 non-governmental agencies, and 28 lead authors of the IPCC Second Assessment Report. As a lead author of the evidence chapter, I was there among them in that Madrid plenary room. So were several of the other characters in Kyoto, including the play's central one, Donald Perlman, who was a lawyer and lobbyist for the Climate Council, a consortium of energy interests. Perlman and I were on opposite sides of the Madrid chessboard. My efforts were directed toward synthesizing and assessing complex science and ensuring that the science was accurately represented in the IPCC report. His were directed toward delaying international efforts to reduce emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. Such reductions were bad for the business interests he represented and for the revenues of oil-producing countries such as Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. Perlman, who died in 2005, understood the singular importance of the Madrid discernible human influence conclusion. He knew it was the scientific writing on the wall. The jury was no longer out. Human-caused fingerprints had been identified in records of Earth's surface and atmospheric temperatures. Humans were not innocent bystanders in the climate system. They were active participants. Burning fossil fuels had changed the chemistry of Earth's atmosphere, thereby warming the planet and sending Earth's vital signs into concerning territory. The Madrid conclusion meant the days of unfettered fossil fuel use and carbon pollution were numbered. It also made Perlman's lobbying job more difficult. His response was to attack the science and the scientists as part of a rearguard action to delay international agreement on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. As Perlman's character explains in Kyoto, it was a deliberate scorched earth strategy. Torch the science and the scientists. I experienced this strategy firsthand in a memorable personal meeting with Perlman in Washington, D.C. on May 21, 1996. After I spoke at the U.S. Congress's Rayburn House office building about the scientific evidence for human fingerprints on global climate, Perlman confronted me and started screaming at me, literally screaming. He expressed outrage at what he claimed were unauthorized changes to the chapter I had been responsible for. The changes had in fact been authorized by the IPCC, as Perlman knew very well. He had been present at the Madrid meeting where the changes were discussed. Ultimately, he lost. Despite tremendous differences among countries in terms of their national self-interest, culpability for the problems of human-caused climate change, and vulnerability to the effects of climate change, an international agreement was finally reached. The 1997 Kyoto Protocol commits participating countries to a common goal, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and avoiding dangerous anthropogenic interference in Earth's climate system. Kyoto is the dynamic story of how that agreement was achieved. In one memorable line in the play, Perlman's wife, Shirley, asks him, "Are we on the wrong side?" The question is prompted by an exposé of Perlman's lobbying activities in the German news magazine Der Spiegel. Shirley wants to know whether her husband's efforts to cast doubt on the climate change science and on the scientists involved in advancing that science place them on the wrong side of history. The Perlman character in the play responds, "No, Shirley, we're not on the wrong side." But Perlman and the industries he represented were on the wrong side of the science. Nearly 30 years after the Madrid IPCC meeting, and after Perlman's concerted efforts to undercut climate science, human fingerprints on Earth's climate are now unequivocal and ubiquitous. The cautious 1995 discernible human influence finding has been confirmed and strengthened by all four subsequent IPCC assessments. The scientists in Madrid got it right. Perlman and his employers were also on the wrong side of history. Today, 191 countries have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Although the U.S. Congress never did ratify it, the protocol helped to pave the way for the 2016 Paris Agreement. The serious consequences of human-caused global warming are now manifest to all, building momentum for real action to cut carbon pollution. The days of climate science denial are numbered. But they are not quite over yet. Another Donald, former President Donald Trump, and of course now President, has repeatedly denied the reality and seriousness of climate change. It's no surprise that his backers look a lot like Perlman's. There is a very small probability that Trump will ever watch Kyoto. There's an even smaller probability that Trump will consider whether he, too, is on the wrong side of science and history. Sadly, he is. Trump's return to the U.S. presidency would reprise Perlman's heyday, when manufactured doubts obscured mature scientific understanding. Since the writing and publication of this article, Trump did indeed return to the White House and is promoting doubt regarding scientific understanding. In 2016, the U.S. did sign the Paris Agreement and committed to reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And then, in 2021, after withdrawing under President Trump in 2020, it rejoined. However, in 2025, the U.S. announced its intent to again withdraw from the agreement. Kyoto tells the story of how that scientific understanding evolved and how powerful vested interests tried to destroy it. It is absolutely vital to give that account today, with the bill for climate change coming due all around us. I hope Kyoto reaches audiences I could never dream of reaching through all scientific papers I've ever written, and I hope it provides us with what mathematicians call an existence principle, proof that something difficult is possible. The existence principle in Kyoto is that humanity can come together and solve a seemingly intractable problem. This commentary in Forum in the November 2024 issue of Scientific American was written by Ben Santer. He is a climate scientist and a John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Fellow. From 1992 until his retirement in 2021, Santer pursued research in climate fingerprinting at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California. He was a contributor to all six of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's completed scientific assessments. These days, we all need a good laugh. From the January 2025 issue of Scientific American, "The Origin of Joking," "Evolution," "Studies of Great Apes Hint at Why and When Clowning Behavior Evolved," by Erica Cartmill. One sunny afternoon in San Diego, 3-year-old Aisha played outside while her father sat nearby. Her father wasn't paying much attention to her, so Aisha took a toy and waved it at him. When he didn't respond, she redoubled her efforts, gently bonking him on the head with the toy. She looked at her dad's face expectantly, but to no avail. Aisha then waved the toy in her dad's face and brushed it across the top of his head, making it harder and harder for him to ignore her. Finally, he gave in and watched while she swung on a swing. Like most three-year-olds you might know, Aisha could be a handful. Unlike those three-year-olds, Aisha is an orangutan. She is 11 now, and she and her family live at the San Diego Zoo. Throughout her childhood, Aisha spent her days playing, eating, sleeping, and frequently bugging her parents. Aisha's behavior toward her father probably sounds familiar. You're likely to see similar behavior from a bored toddler and her father in a supermarket checkout line. Where does this urge to bug, mess with, or tease others come from? Is the similarity between Aisha's behavior and that of a human child merely a superficial resemblance, or is it the result of deep commonalities in the way we play, learn, and think? Over the past several years, my colleagues and I have been studying teasing in humans and great apes to figure out why and when this behavior evolved. Teasing exists in a gray area between play and aggression. It can sometimes lead to bullying and ostracism, but it can also be loving and even endearing. For humans, playful teasing, which includes clowning, pranking, and joking, provides a wonderful space to learn about social relationships. It can test those relationships by gently stretching the boundaries of social norms and seeing what one can get away with. And it can advertise the strength of those relationships to others. Imagine watching a group of friends playfully insult one another. We think much the same is true for the other great apes. Although scholars have traditionally viewed humor as a uniquely human trait, our findings suggest that it has surprisingly deep roots. I first started thinking about the origin of humor in 2005, when I was researching orangutan communication for my PhD. I was at a zoo studying how orangutans use gestures to communicate. One day, I witnessed a fascinating interaction that I didn't know how to categorize or analyze. An infant orangutan was dangling from a rope over her mother, who was lying on her back in a pile of straw. The infant extended a large piece of bark toward her mother, and her mother reached for it. At the last second, the infant pulled the bark back out of her mother's grasp. Her mother lowered her hand. The infant offered the bark again. This, "here, take it, oops, just kidding," behavior happened a few more times until the infant dropped the piece of bark. To my surprise, the mother then picked it up and started doing the same thing back toward the infant. This role reversal was intriguing. Now it wasn't just a tolerant mother going along with her daughter. It was a game, or maybe a joke. It had the core features of a joke: a setup, the offer, and a punchline, the withdrawal. Surely it wasn't a great joke. It wouldn't appear in anyone's stand-up routine, but it seemed like the kind of joke a toddler might enjoy. Young children find repetitive physical jokes incredibly entertaining. The humor centers on a moment of surprise, something unexpectedly happening. And yet, these interactions are typically repeated over and over. The unexpected moment becomes an unexpected part of the game. Peekaboo. This kind of expected surprise is the basis of a lot of humor. Jokes often involve a conventionalized setup. Knock, knock. What's the deal with? Did you ever notice how? What's the difference between? The framing primes the listeners for a punchline, letting them know they should listen to the language that follows in a less literal way. Children begin creating these unexpected moments before their first birthday, even before they say their first word. Vasu Reddy, a psychologist at the University of Portsmouth in England, calls these interactions clowning behaviors and highlights three common types: offer and withdrawal, disruption of others' activities, and provocative noncompliance, intentionally doing something that violates a norm or rule. A human infant might offer an object and pull it back at the last second, just as I saw the infant orangutan do. They might demonstrate noncompliance by putting a shoe on their head, like a hat, instead of on their foot, smiling as they do so. An infant's primary motivation for clowning seems to be engagement with others, not violation of rules. These are playful social behaviors. Youngsters frequently laugh while clowning and look toward the faces of the adults for a reaction. The exchange between the infant and mother orangutan wasn't immediately relevant to what I was researching at the time, but it stuck in my mind, along with other instances of teasing that I occasionally observed while studying gestural communication in this species. Eventually, my research focus shifted, and I got more and more interested in the cognition that drives communication. I began to think about those teasing interactions I had witnessed. They weren't necessarily part of the communication systems I had been studying, but they involved understanding the minds of others. It occurred to me that those behaviors could provide an interesting lens on the evolution of social intelligence. Orangutans and humans are both great apes, along with chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas. Members of this group have many things in common. We have big brains and long childhoods. We laugh, mourn, get jealous, and hold grudges. We recognize ourselves in mirrors and understand that others can know things we don't. Great apes have well-developed social intelligence. We are very interested in other individuals, and we spend a lot of time playing with, learning from, fighting over, getting even with, and befriending them. Could playful teasing have evolved as part of this intense interest in the goals, feelings, and relationships of others? Getting at this question would require systematically observing the great apes for the presence of teasing behaviors, something that, to my knowledge, no one had done before. In early 2020, I assembled a team of students, postdocs, and colleagues, including Isabel Laumer, Johanna Eckert, and Sasha Winkler, all then at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Federico Rossano of the University of California, San Diego, to conduct this research. We initially planned a series of hands-on studies in zoos, but the world had other plans. Like humans, the other great apes are susceptible to COVID, so at the height of the pandemic, the primate research community paused all research that involved interacting directly with great apes. We decided to carry out a video-based study instead. Using footage of orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, and bonobos in zoos in the U.S. and Europe, we identified social interactions that appeared to contain a mix of playful and annoying elements. We explicitly avoided any cases of pure aggression or pure play so we could focus on the gray area in between. Social cognition is difficult to study, particularly in animals as complicated as great apes. Researchers studying humans can use questionnaires to ask people what they think about others' intentions or beliefs. But studies of non-human apes and human infants must measure subjects' thinking without language. For example, by observing and coding natural interactions or by measuring the behaviors individuals produce when presented with sounds, images, or puzzles. We developed a coding system for teasing that builds on those used to study ape communication. Behavioral coding systems are the most common way to study interactions between animals or people when you are observing them from a distance. They consist of a set of codes, basically labels, and a set of rules about how to apply those codes. Systematic appliance application of the codes, according to the rules, turns messy real-world interactions into quantifiable variables that can be analyzed statistically. It also can be used to confirm that behaviors seen by one person are also seen by others, giving researchers a way to bolster the reliability of their observations. This approach helps to ensure that the phenomenon is not merely in the eye of the beholder. In developing our coding system, we made sure to include things such as the identity of the teaser and target, the teaser's actions, whether the teaser waited for a response from the target, whether there were any repetitions of behavior, and whether interactions were primarily one-sided or reciprocal. We also coded for elements of play, including facial expressions, gestures, relaxation, and evidence of mutual enjoyment. For instance, both parties willingly continuing an interaction. Three of us worked together to code categories, apply them, discuss them, revise them, and apply them again. We repeated this process several times until we were happy with the coding system we had developed and satisfied that we were all applying it in the same way. Our final coding system identified five main characteristics of playful teasing: a provocative behavior, a mainly one-sided provocation, an element of surprise, such as the teaser approaching the target from behind, a look from the teaser toward the target's face, and repetition or elaboration of the provocative behavior. Very few of the examples we observed had all five of these traits, but 129 examples had at least three of the five. The most difficult teasing characteristic to define, and arguably the most important, was the presence of provocative behavior. It was reliably coded the same way by different people, so we knew it could be identified, but it was hard to put into words. We ultimately decided that the best definition was something that was difficult for the target to ignore. This could involve the teaser doing something very slowly or very quickly, directly in front of the target. It could involve shaking or pounding on something the target was sitting on. It could even involve the teaser leaning into the target's face until they were almost touching. These behaviors have very different forms, but they are all things that could be difficult to ignore. The four kinds of great apes we studied live in very different social groups and natural environments in the wild. Orangutans are largely solitary and spend most of their time up in the trees. Gorillas live on the ground in social groups made up of one adult male and multiple adult females and young. Chimpanzees and bonobos spend time both in the trees and on the ground, and they live in big communities composed of multiple males and multiple females. But whereas chimpanzees have male-dominated societies with relatively high levels of aggression between adults, bonobos live in mostly matriarchal societies and tend to respond to conflict not with fighting, but with sex. Despite these profound differences in their ways of life, all four species playfully teased one another in largely similar ways. They poked, hit, pushed, pulled, and tickled one another. There was a lot of swinging and waving of arms, legs, and objects. A teaser might grab another's hand or foot to stop their activity. Sometimes apes hid under objects when teasing, popping a hand out to pull someone's hair or somersaulting into another individual while inside a burlap sack. On one occasion, a juvenile chimpanzee named Azebo approached his mother while she was grooming another chimpanzee and smacked her on the back, then retreated and looked at her from a safe distance. The juvenile repeated the provocation multiple times. The mother ineffectually swatted the air in response, gently grabbing toward Azebo while continuing to groom the other ape. This kind of behavior is different from regular play. When two apes play, the interaction is more symmetrical. They approach each other and stay together while they interact, or they chase each other. Azebo's repeated provoke and remove to a safe distance pattern is playful, but it is also provocative, a characteristic of teasing. Young apes were more likely to tease than adult apes, but adults teased too. In another interaction, a zebo had a stick that he was using to try to get into a feeder. Every time the youngster tried to insert the stick into a hole in the feeder, an adult named Sandra blocked his attempt by covering the hole or by grabbing the tool and then dropping it on the ground. Sandra didn't want the tool for herself. She just wanted to tease a zebo. Teasing actions were used in ways that appeared specifically intended to elicit a response from the target. Apes weren't just treating others as part of the environment. They were expecting an interaction. During and after teasing actions, apes looked at the target to gauge their response. They then repeated their actions or elaborated them. A poke might turn into a hair pull. Waving a toy might turn into a bonk on the head. This provocative, persistent, escalating teasing seems incredibly irritating, but the response of other apes were almost never aggressive. Targets tended to ignore teasers or try to gently shrug, wave, or shoo them away. Sometimes they responded positively, reciprocating with play, an embrace, or teasing of their own. Other times they just got up and left. Apes were typically relaxed before teasing began, and teasing did not agitate either the teaser or the target. Although teasers were trying to goad their targets, they were doing it in a low-stakes way. Playful teasing most likely happens during periods of boredom, not stress. Think of kids in the back seat on a road trip. That's an ideal environment for teasing. The presence of playful teasing in all four of our great ape cousins suggests that it benefits them in important ways. We can look to this behavior in humans to see how it might be advantageous. Playful teasing provides a rich opportunity to learn about others' minds. The teaser has to predict the target's response and adjust their behavior based on how the target is likely to respond. Things that might be received well by a close friend would not be by a stranger. You can call your best friend a slut, a punk, or a weenie, and they might playfully insult you back, but you are unlikely to get the same response from your boss or a tax auditor. Even within close relationships, friendships, someone's response might vary from day to day or from hour to hour, depending on the person's mood and your previous interactions. Learning to predict how others will respond to you is a critical skill for highly social animals like humans and other apes. Who will have your back if you get into a fight? Who will give you the benefit of the doubt if your actions or intentions are ambiguous? Playful teasing provides a relatively low-risk environment in which to develop and refine your social prediction skills. Being able to predict and understand the goals, intentions, knowledge, and desires of others is the basis for human language and culture. Although non-human apes do not have language, they do share some of these foundational skills, and playful teasing provides a window onto them. Most animals play, but playful teasing may offer an opportunity to move from physical to mental play, from playing with bodies to playing with minds. We're only just beginning to understand teasing and how it relates to social cognition in creatures other than humans. Can apes predict whether someone will be surprised? My colleagues and I are using methods such as eye tracking to study what apes pay attention to when watching others interact. Do apes get excited when they anticipate a strong reaction in a social interaction? We are using thermal imaging to measure changes in blood flow around the eyes and ears, a physiological sign of excitement, when we expect a social scene may be funny, scary, or exciting to an ape. We're still collecting and analyzing data for these projects, but a small pilot study using thermal imaging with bonobos suggests at least some apes get excited when they see another ape get tickled, for instance. By combining biological measures such as eye position and blood flow with behavioral measures such as an ape's preference for different partners in a game, we can develop a more complete picture of how attention, memory, mood, and prediction combine when apes are thinking about others. Although playful teasing has been systematically studied only in humans and other apes, we suspect that other animals do it too. If it provides a way to build, test, and show off relationships, as well as an opportunity to practice predicting others' behavior, then we might expect it to evolve in other highly social animals with big brains, few predators, and long childhoods. Parrots, dolphins, elephants, whales, and dogs are all good candidates. Our group is studying a few of these non-primate species, but it will take many more observers to get a clear understanding of what playful teasing looks like across the animal kingdom. To get more people involved, we recently surveyed zookeepers in more than 100 zoos, and we are now collecting stories about animal teasing from folks around the world. If you have stories or recordings of animals playfully teasing you or other animals, we invite you to share them on our website, www.observinganimals.org/teasing. Getting a big picture of playful teasing across the animal kingdom will inform how we study the origin and evolution of this behavior. Already, observations of teasing in all the great ape species suggest the roots of human humor may go back 13 million years or more to the last common ancestor of Aisha the orangutan and the bored child in the checkout line. They may not get a Netflix comedy special, but teasing apes provide strong evidence the first joke is far older than the early human who extended a hand in the firelight and said, "Pull my finger." And the scientist, whose studies of great apes hint at why and when clowning behavior evolved, Erica Cartmill, is a professor of anthropology, cognitive science, and animal behavior at Indiana University Bloomington. She studies the evolution of cognition and communication. And her article about her study appears in the January 2025 issue of Scientific American. The following articles were originally broadcast on September 29, 2024. We begin with an article from Advances, the September 2024 issue of Scientific American, in the Department of Animal Behavior, Long Distance Contacts, Elephants Call One Another by Name Across the Savannah. Humans have a long history of inventing names for elephants. There is Disney's Dumbo, of course, and Jumbo, a 19th century circus attraction, and the famed painting elephant, Ruby, from the Phoenix Zoo. But new research suggests wild African elephants may invent names, too, and use them to call and greet one another on the savannah. Most animals are born with a fixed set of sounds for communication. A few, such as songbirds, can imitate other sounds they hear around them. Certain species of dolphins and parrots may learn to mimic human words for objects in their environment, like the proverbial Polly who wants a cracker. Much rarer, however, is the ability to attach vocal labels, something akin to names, to fellow members of the flock or pod. Bottlenose dolphins and orange-fronted parakeets are thought to address peers with specific calls, to which a unique receiver tends to react. But in these cases, the calls consist of one animal simply imitating the features of another's habitual or trademark sound. It's as if someone went around constantly repeating their own name, like Mark, and you mimicked it back at them. A dolphin may copy another dolphin's signature whistle to attract its attention, and the second animal will respond by repeating that very same whistle. Now, a study in the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution reveals that African elephants engage in a type of communication previously unknown in non-human animals. Researchers used machine learning to analyze 469 contact, greeting, and caregiving rumbles made by wild female savanna elephants in Kenya and discovered that the animals use specific vocal labels to identify one another. Instead of merely imitating an individual's signature call to signal a particular elephant's identity, they come up with an original sound. It might seem obvious to me and other elephant researchers that these calls are very specific because you see that a certain individual will respond, but no one has previously shown it, says Caitlin O'Connell Rodwell, an elephant behavioral ecologist at Harvard Medical School, who was not part of the new study. People typically associate elephants with loud trumpeting, but the most common elephant sound is actually a low-frequency rumble. Some rumbles are so deep that humans cannot detect them. We hear only down to about 20 hertz, and these sounds reach as low as 5 hertz. Elephants, however, possess unique ear anatomy designed to pick up such rumbles from as far away as 1.5 miles. This range is important because female savanna elephants live in an elaborate fission-fusion society. Their extended family units split up and regroup on a regular basis as they follow food resources and avoid predators. Study co-author Joyce Poole, a co-founder of the charity Elephant Voices, has been studying elephants for almost 5 decades. She long suspected that these cognitively advanced animals, which show empathy, mourn their dead, and may imitate human speech, address one another from afar with something resembling names. She says she has often observed an elephant calling out and only one responding. The others would just keep on feeding as if they hadn't even heard her, Poole says. I did wonder, are they being just rude by not answering, or is it because she's actually addressing somebody specific? Machine learning helped Poole and her colleagues locate vocal labels among the hundreds of previously recorded female elephant calls. To discern which specific elephants were addressing each other, Poole went back to her old field notes, looking for interactions such as so-and-so was separate from so-and-so and was calling so-and-so. The researchers ultimately identified 101 callers and 117 receivers. Next, they measured acoustic features of the calls to assess whether they contained individual labels. The resulting model was able to predict the specific receiver of a call with a success rate far better than chance. The vocalizations weren't simply dolphin-like imitation, either. Poole and her colleagues found no statistical evidence of the animals copying one another. The researchers then verified their findings in the field. They approached 17 wild elephants and played calls addressed to each of them through a speaker. Although the elephants rarely reacted to the names of other animals, they quickly responded to their own. It's a very sharp response, Poole says. The heads jerk up, the ears spread out, the mouths open wide. Study lead author Michael Pardo, a behavioral ecologist now at Cornell University, notes that the researchers couldn't pinpoint which part of a call was labeling an individual and that the data were inconclusive on whether multiple elephants used the same name for an individual. It's possible that the recordings simply lack sufficient examples, or that different elephants use slightly different versions of the same name. To parse the calls, the researchers may need to collect many more samples of elephant rumbles, a challenging task that would entail spending many hours in close proximity to the studied group. Collecting this type of data is really intense, says study senior author and Colorado State University biologist George Whitmire. Although humans are still just scratching the surface of elephant communication, Whitmire suggests the existence of individual vocal labels in these calls indicates a capacity for abstract thinking. What's more, he says, studying such labels could add to our understanding of how human language might have evolved. In complex societies where members often lose sight of one another, such as those of elephants or our hominin ancestors, the need to identify others and attract their attention might have driven cognitive abilities and language development. If you can name things without relying on imitation, then, at least in theory, it is possible for you to talk about a wider range of subjects, because you could potentially come up with names for objects and ideas that don't make any imitable sound, Pardo says. As O'Connell Rodwell puts it, modifying a vocalization tailored to a specific individual does get you into a conversation, and that's what I would say is a first step. This article was written by Marta Zaraska. The opening paragraph of this article caught my eye. Humans have a long history of inventing names for elephants. There is Disney's Dumbo, of course, and Jumbo, a 19th century circus attraction, and the famed painting elephant Ruby from the Phoenix Zoo. Who is Ruby? I went to Wikipedia and an article from the Phoenix New Times from the late 1990s, and this is what I learned. Ruby, born July 13, 1973, and died on November 6, 1998, was a 4.5-ton Asian elephant who lived at the Phoenix Zoo and was famous for creating paintings. The most expensive of her paintings sold for $25,000. Ruby was born in Thailand and was shipped to the Phoenix Zoo in February 1974, when she was about 7 months old. Initially, she lived with a goat and some chickens for a few years without any elephant companionship. This initial period was difficult for Ruby. She would scatter grain in her small 20 by 30 foot enclosure to lure ducks into range, and then she stomped them to death. In time, she was moved into the main enclosure with the zoo's two other elephants, both African. Ruby got along with the other two. African and Asian elephants are of different species. Zoo officials decided to breed her to provide her with companionship. Ruby's painting career began when her keepers saw her scratching in the dirt of her enclosure with a stick, and they offered her a brush and paints. Ruby painted twice a week. She was a fast painter, typically completing a painting in 10 minutes. For 3 years, zookeepers did not publicize the knowledge that Ruby could paint. Eventually, they revealed this and were able to sell her paintings to raise $50,000 for conservation efforts. Ruby's paintings were abstract in composition with multiple colors. An ophthalmologist determined that she has preferences for different colors. Two plates that she painted were appraised on the PBS television show Antiques Roadshow for $1,500 in 2015. In 1996, when she was 22 years old, Ruby was shipped to the Tulsa, Oklahoma Zoo to mate with a male elephant named Alan, who still lives in Tulsa, and lived in Tulsa for about a year. When Ruby became pregnant in 1997, she was returned to the Phoenix Zoo. Another female Asian elephant, Indu, was loaned from the Houston Zoo to be Ruby's birthing companion. Indu still lives at the Phoenix Zoo. At the end of October 1998, Ruby began to show signs of labor, but the birth didn't start. On Halloween, the zoo's veterinarians determined that her calf had died in her womb, and the decision was made to perform a cesarean operation. When surgery began on November 6th, it was discovered that her uterus had ripped and a massive infection had spread through her abdominal cavity. Her male fetal calf weighed 300 pounds, twice the size of a normal newborn infant. Elephant infant, that is. Ruby was euthanized immediately, and her death triggered an outpouring of grief throughout the Phoenix area. When the Phoenix Zoo announced a free admission day in honor of Ruby's memory, 40,000 people attended, nearly triple a normal day's attendance. In the late 1990s, the caretaker's house, a small stone cottage on the zoo grounds left over from when the zoo site was a fish hatchery, operating from the 1930s to the 1950s, was extensively renovated and dedicated to Ruby's memory and honor. Ruby's house has become a popular venue at the Phoenix Zoo for weddings and receptions. Meanwhile, on December 10, 1998, an article by Amy Silverman was posted in the Phoenix New Times entitled, "Trunk Murder." Ruby, the Phoenix Zoo's Asian elephant, died last month when her pregnancy went awry, and the city got the blues. Ruby had lived here almost 25 years, longer than most of us, and she'd become famous as one of the world's most unlikely painters. Her works raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. She was a landmark in a city with few enduring icons. The city was soggy with tears. The outpouring of grief, the candlelight vigils, flowers, cards, and poetry came in a deluge. You'd have thought Princess Diana had died all over again. The zoo almost tripled its attendance record at the free day dedicated to Ruby's memory when 40,000 people showed up. I heard of Ruby's death on a Friday afternoon at work, raced for the Kleenex box, and driving home that night, I sobbed along to "Goodbye Ruby Tuesday" on the radio and wished I owned one of Ruby's paintings. For days, I couldn't hear her name without getting misty. Alas, poor Ruby, cut short in her prime, robbed by fate of the joy of motherhood. I felt really bad. But I was about to feel worse. I was about to speak to Dale Jameson. Dale Jameson is the Henry R. Luce Professor in Human Dimensions of Global Change at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. That is, he was at the time of the writing of this article in 1998. For the past 13 years, he's been a thorn in the paw of the North American zoo community, challenging its concept of zoos in general and criticizing specific zoo practices, like the breeding of captive Asian elephants. Based on Jameson's beliefs, Ruby shouldn't have died. She shouldn't have been bred in the first place. According to him, Ruby shouldn't have lived at the zoo, let alone become a renowned pachyderm painter. Here's what he believes. Elephants don't belong in captivity. We don't have the right to keep them for our entertainment. There's no educational value in seeing them in zoos. There is no humane way to keep elephants in captivity. And particularly pertinent to Ruby, there is no biological reason to breed them in captivity. The reason that zoos like yours breed elephants, he said, has very little to do with any endangered species issues. It has to do with the fact that baby elephants bring people to zoos, he says. This background on Ruby, the painting elephant in the Phoenix Zoo in the late 1990s, came from Wikipedia and a December 1998 article from the Phoenix New Times. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next Sunday.